Okay, well, thank you. So this is work that was initiated actually with Dave Casper, who was then a graduate student in math at UC Berkeley, and I was spending a sabbatical there. So this was basically the pinning work. The coagulation work, which basically builds on this, was done jointly with Melike Sherry, who was then an undergraduate in his second year looking for a research project. And he turned out to be really a superb student. He's at USC now as a graduate student. He converted to applied mathematics as a result of this project. So the field has lost him. Then some other field has gained him. Matt Tarzi, who will be here next week on Monday, was sort of the memory stuff. We had this model. It had his heuristic behavior. I gave this as a master's thesis to Matt to get an idea of what this is. And what I'm going to be talking about is actually stuff that's been built on the insight that we gained from Matt's master's thesis. Matt is continuing, and he's about to finish his PhD in physics at CMU Carnegie Mellon. So this is the cast. The stuff on the depinning and coagulation is in three papers. These have been published. The memory and RPM stuff is the stuff that we are doing. We are basically in the write-up. I'm hoping that we have something in archive, you know, within the week or next week. But I'm more than happy to talk about this. I will talk only a little bit about the depinning and coagulation stuff. I will talk mostly about memory, but the coagulation thing relates to the memory, so I want to sort of at least give you the gist of it, and then we will just hop into memory. The talk will be two parts, a short part on coagulation, then the main stuff is memory. Okay, so depinning, you can consider it as a paradigm for models of frictions, earthquakes. You know, it's not clear how serious one should take this. However, what is common is you have some interface that is pinned by this order. You are interested in the shape deformations of this interface as you load the system. What is happening on a microscopic level is, you know, the system appears to be macroscopically kind of just stationary, but on a microscopic level, you have sort of, you know, at the interface, you have sort of avalanches, you have stress relaxation, and, you know, you increase the loading, there are bigger avalanches, there are more avalanches, and then eventually your point where the system cannot be macroscopically stationary and you have a sliding phase. So what we will be interested in is in the characterization of the subthreshold evolution towards depinning. I will give you brief results on this, but the main talk, as I said, is about hysteresis. Now, this transition into the sliding phase, this is at this point you can believe that temperature does very, very little, if at all. The thermal scales, you know, activation scales are much, much longer than the scales on which you perform the experiment. So in some sense, if you consider people have likened this transition from a pinned configuration to a depinned configuration, like a phase transition, but here your control parameter is not the temperature, but it's the loading, and the noise that you get is not temporally varying noise, if you like, but it is quench disorder. And one of the questions is, you know, to what extent and how serious should one consider this depinning transition really as a honest to goodness phase transition? There has been criticality observed, but the techniques to sort of get at these phase transitions are in some sense formal techniques. There's numerical simulations. The formal techniques are functional renormalization group techniques. But in some sense, when we started out with Dave working on this, we wanted to have a model that is simple enough that I can understand the depinning transition from first principles. And that means ideas of probability and statistics. So, you know, really ingredients, no sort of big machinery of kind of loop calculations and so on and so forth. And then understand whether dynamic critical phenomena are really just plain old critical phenomena that we know from statistical mechanics. Just instead of temperature, now you have a disorder that's coming from the depinning. So the idea is not doing something maybe realistic, but doing something controlled. A simple model that is still non-trivial, for which you can get results applying basic principles. And so you're looking at a one-dimensional charge density wave type model. And the results that we obtain is that the threshold configuration, sort of the most strained configuration before the thing starts to slide, can be described as a solution of a variational problem. This can be done, this can be proven. So, in the case that the pinning is very strong, we obtain a sort of slightly simpler model that's called the toy model. And for that toy model, you can actually solve this variational problem exactly. So, which means you can characterize the roughness of the threshold configuration and see what happens to this in the limit that the system size goes to infinity, and so on and so forth. then you can ask, well, what is the evolution towards threshold? I start with some pint configuration. I'm not interested in this sliding configuration. I'm starting out with a pint configuration. I'm loading it. I know what the threshold configuration is going to be. So what is the evolution towards it? And basically, the prediction is if this is scaling behavior, the correlation length is growing, and then eventually you get into the finite size regime. And what we were able to show is in this model that this growth of the correlation length, which kind of determines everything else in the model, is governed by a coagulation process. And that is maybe sort of the kind of surprise and interesting thing that hadn't been noticed really before. So, as I said, that this correlation process will play some role if you look at the hysteretic behavior of this toy model. And so this is why I want to just briefly talk a little bit about the coagulation process. But as I said, the main talk is about this, and this is all kind of just advertisement, what you can find in the papers that have been published so far.
Okay.
Yeah.
So I remember the Frankel-Kantarova model. Charge density waves are driven by electric field. I forgot what the...
The Frankel-Kantarova model? Okay, give me a minute and I'll tell you where the Frankel-Kantarova model sits. Okay?
And are these things in 1D versus 2D? Is there...
No. It's basically... Give me a minute, and I'll tell you what the Frankel-Kantarova model is. Okay, so this is basically the preview. So what is the model? It's a charge density wave kind of inspired model, which is related to Frankel-Kantarova models. You have basically, and we will think about this just classical mechanics. So you have a 1D chain of particles connected by Hookian harmonic springs. It is the Hamiltonian of the system is basically, I've set the spring constant to 1. I is the particle index. I'm imposing periodic boundary conditions. The system size is L. So here is the elastic term, okay? The position of the ith particle minus its neighbor square. Then I have a pinning strength here. So I set the spring constant 1. So the strength of is measured in terms of lambda times the potential V, which is going to be 1 periodic. It has a period of 1. So I've set the periodic length scale as my unit, okay? But each particle sees the same periodic potential, however, with a phase offset. Okay, and the phase offset in these charge density waves is a random number. In the case of Frankel-Kantarova, this phase offset would be just a wave number times I. So in the Frankel-Kantarova, you would have basically two competing length scales. In a way, the kind of the period of the potential and sort of the equilibrium length of the unstretched springs, okay? And that would basically appear here in this potential as a, instead of alpha, you would have just Q, the wave number, times I, okay? Here I have each particle sees the same potential with the random phase offset. And now to make these things also analytical tractable, the potential that I will use is something that, you know, it's a cusped repeated parabola. So this is a parabola that is the unit cell goes from -1/2 to 1/2, and it's periodically repeated. Okay? So this is the potential, and this is, I want to get the dynamics. The dynamics is basically purely relaxational. That is why the Hamiltonian doesn't have any kinetic energy terms. Okay? So it's you take the partial of H with respect to the coordinates, and you do this purely relaxational. Yeah.
Just to be clear, are you planning to move these particles along the line that they're in or perpendicular?
In the end, it doesn't matter. In Frankel-Kantarova, you typically think you have an infinite chain or bi-infinite chain, and then you have sort of like a spring, and you move the thing you move it longitudinal, okay? In this case, I will think about this as an interface problem. This is exactly here.
Yes, so explain.
Okay, so let me just sort of spend a minute on this figure then. Okay, so it's now I've kind of... Sorry. Okay, so...
Can you go back?
Yeah, sure.
So... not very important, but the period is the alpha I or the random phase.
Yeah.
The period is
just this period is, I've just set the period equal to 1. Yeah. And then across the I, across the particles, and these I particles are chained, and they're sitting really on there's periodic boundary conditions. Okay, so yi is basically the position of the ith particle, and as I'm going to think about the transverse motion as you were saying, Robin, as Robin was saying, so this is what it would kind of look like. So this axis here is the particle index. This is the position of the ith particle. The blue guys are kind of the springs because I was too lazy to draw these things, but I could do this. And then red is the position of the particles. I've shown, so each of them sees basically the cusp potential. These vertical points are just the location of the cusp. They're, of course, equally spaced, but you see they are not at the same height because there is a phase offset. This represents the phase offset. So now, using the quadratic, basically parabolic potential, makes the response to a force really trivial. Okay, so when I force this system, this configuration just rigidly slides up and down. Okay, because the restoring forces on the springs as well as the potential are all linear. Okay, so this is basically rigid translation. Okay, and this is okay because I'm not interested in the rigid translation. I'm interested in what happens when one of these particles hits the cusp. Okay, and then, you know, it's up until then, I can translate it up and down, and this is completely reversible as long as none of the particles reaches the cusp. Okay, so therefore, this is okay, and this should be okay. So now I want to make the system a little bit, I do something that simplifies looking at this system. In a way, I don't care really. You see, I'm dealing with static configurations. So the idea will be, you know, I'm doing everything in the adiabatic limit. I'm increasing the force a little bit. The system will relax, but it will relax on time scales much, much, you know, shorter than the scales at which I'm changing the force. Okay? So really, in some sense, all I want to know is in which well is the particle? Okay? Is it in this one, this one, this one? I don't care about where exactly the particle is. Or this will be kind of, it will be secondary. So what I do is I take this continuous height variable, and I split it into its well part and its location inside the well part. Okay, so this is what I've shown you here. Okay, so this is the continuous height variable. There is an overall offset that comes from the phase offset. This is an integer m that tells me you are in the fifth well or in the minus sixth well, and then the rest here is kind of like the local coordinate. Okay, and I've chosen the coordinate so that if this guy is zero, you're exactly at the center. If it is 1/2 or minus 1/2, you're at one of the cusps. Okay, now I'm interested in strong pinning, and since I'm interested in strong pinning, these guys here, y tilde, all fall into an interval of width 1 over the disorder strength. So therefore, I want to get rid of the disorder strength. So instead of writing this like this, I write this as z over the disorder. And so now z is a number of order 1. Okay? This is the mode. And so our goal will be increase the force just enough to get one particle to the cusp, do all the jumps that you have to do. You have a new configuration, then you increase the force again, you get a new configuration. Where does this lead me? Okay. Now this has become an automaton now. Okay. In some sense, the driving of the forcing has been kind of, you know, the effect of the driving has been kind of, you know, removed out of the problem. I just get it to a cusp, let it jump, and so on and so forth. Yes?
There is momentum in the jumping process? I mean,
no, everything is purely relaxational. So there's no inertia terms in this.
Okay. Calculating the force at every time step.
Yeah, but it turns out I will, you know, it's, you know, calculating the force or calculate, you know, since everything is translating uniformly, I could also calculate by how much I have to translate it. You know, I can calculate the strain if you like, and then dividing by, you know, the effective spring constant, I get the stress.
But as you're applying this load, you're building up all this potential energy.
That's true.
Your assumption is that
it gets dissipated away.
Nothing rolls downhill.
It will, but it will roll downhill when it cuts the other side.
But
it happens so it's so overdamped. You know, it will happen. It will happen on time scales much faster than I'm loading the system. So whenever I see the system, it is essentially in one static equilibrium. Okay, and I'm interested in the transition from one static equilibrium to the other. Whenever you sort of just force the system enough that one particle is basically, you know, thrown over the cusp, the system relaxes. I get a new configuration. Okay, so basically what all of this has boiled down to, I started with this charge tensor, is a simple kind of automaton. Okay, and this automaton is for, you have L particles, as we had, index from 0 to L. The neighbors of particles are basically I plus minus 1. Now what I have told you is I'm doing the strong pinning, okay, in the strong pinning. Now typically in this problem, if I jiggle this, okay, because of the elastic coupling, these will jiggle, these, everything will jiggle. However, the amount, the kind of the correlation between these, or the amplitudes will decay exponentially, or they will go as powers of 1 over L. So when I jiggle this, this will jiggle at the ratio of 1 over lambda, this jiggles at the ratio of 1 over lambda squared, and so on and so forth. The toy model is basically keep everything only to next nearest. So the elastic couplings basically only influence the nearest neighbor's particles, but nothing beyond. Okay? In that case, you can basically solve the variational problem and get the threshold configuration. Okay, in the other case, there is a variation problem, the solution is more involved. So this is the strong pinning. This is what we call the strong pinning in this model. So, okay, so in that case, so this is now the automaton. It has a very simple prescription. I have L particles, periodic boundary conditions. This quantity Zi is the local position inside the well. The quantity Mi is the, basically, in which well you are. This is my interface, my coarse-grained, if you like, interface height. I have quench disorder, you know, these random phases, basically. And this is I can take this as a IID distributed number between minus 1 and 1. It turns out that from what I'm saying, a lot of the features of the distribution are not so important. But okay, let's just do this. So the static equilibrium configuration is that Z has to be equal to rho I plus the discrete Laplacian of M. This is now the condition for static equilibrium, which means you tell me where in which wells the particles are on a coarse grain level. You give me particle is in well 5, particle 7 is in well 8. I tell you where exactly in the well the particles are. Okay, so this is the constraint. So initially, we start with a flat configuration, so all particles are in their zero well, which means according to this relation, this is zero, so Z is equal to rho I. So initially, you have a bunch of random variables distributed between minus 1 and 1, and now you want to apply the force. Applying the force boils down to this algorithm. So you apply, you had a configuration, you apply the force, some particle jumped, I get a new configuration, the algorithm basically gets directly from the old configuration to the new configuration. And this is what I will call a step, okay? So the algorithm is the following. Get the maximum of Z. I had a bunch of, initially all these Zs are between minus 1 and 1. Get the maximum of Z. Call that maximum HC. There's at least one site at which this maximum is attained. In fact, exactly one, because the probability that two of these Zs have this exactly same value is zero, that this is a finite system. Call that, so for any J, ZJ that is greater or equal to HC, do the following. Increase its M by 1, so that particle has hopped one well. We are driving it up, say, okay? Decrease the Z of that guy by minus 2, and basically increase the Z of its neighbors by plus 1, okay? Now, you see, the thing is that because of these plus 1s, these sets could be bigger than HC because they got a plus. If they are bigger than HC, do the same jump and keep on doing this until all the Zs are strictly less than HC. So you gave me a configuration. So you gave me a configuration meant you gave me a bunch of M's and they're Z's. There is a Z that is the maximum, okay? And so for that.
For EJ, where ZJ is
greater or equal. It has to be greater or equal. Initially, there's just one. Sorry?
Yeah.
There's just one, okay? So for that ZJ, ZJ goes to minus 2, but its neighbors go to plus 1. Okay? So now, so these sets have increased. So if they increase, they could be now bigger than HC. If they're bigger than HC, do the same until all of them are less than HC. Then this is one step.
So just to pick on Karin again from yesterday, so in our model, this is what we would call a synchronous kind of update rather than the extreme one. Extremal would be where you adjust your global, your driving field so that one site is always, one site is a threshold. So I think it's known that in certain classes of models it matters whether you do this update procedure versus the extremal.
But this is extremal because I'm going after the biggest set. You see, and the idea that just...
You're saying that the next level you could have two that go...
You're saying
instead of one.
So there's eight three.
Yeah, so...
I would call this synchronous rather than two. What do you guys call it?
This is another...
that he has an entire avalanche because he's repeating the letter of stable. At a fixed F, right?
Sorry?
At a fixed F, right?
At fixed F, yeah. So I just brought it for... Let's talk about...
It would be where you would adjust F until at each...
Okay, there's something about this model where it might not make a difference, but let's postpone this because I want to get to the...
And I think for positive interactions, in the end, it shouldn't
matter.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, so maybe I want to know more about this, but I think I want to keep it offline, if you're okay. So I call this, why do you go after the biggest set? Because if I increase this is rigid translation, the guy with the biggest set is the furthest ahead in his cell, he will reach a cusp first, okay? So this is this. So, and then, you know, so this is once this thing terminated, you found a new configuration, then you record the new maximum set, you repeat. And so you step to configuration. So this is so easy that the sort of second year undergraduate, you could say, learn C and program this. And so this is how Mendich got on board, okay? So now let me give you a sort of a poor man's simulation of this. This is a system of size 500, okay? These are the indices of the particles, 1 to 500. I have periodic boundary conditions. This is the height variable, my coarse grain thing, okay? So initially, these avalanches are very, very small. What will happen is exactly what Craig said. One particle will jump, its neighbors go up, but not, that's it, okay? So initially, I will just look at every 25th step. I will basically, okay, of this process. And you see stuff is building up. Also, as you see, I've plotted this all the way up to 250 because stuff will grow. So from now on, I'm going step by step. So this is what happens after you've sort of applied this avalanche algorithm 175 times, okay? 176. Okay, this, you are at step 194, and you want to apply this once more, and the algorithm doesn't terminate. And so this is in this model, you know, this is basically something new must have happened. This is basically you've reached the last critical configuration. Beyond that, somehow the configuration cannot find a stable configuration anymore. The algorithm doesn't terminate, and this is the depinning. Okay? So we are basically interested in the evolution from the flat, from something that started flat, right, up to this point. This is what I call the sub-threshold evolution.
The force never drops back down, you just have to keep increasing the force?
Well, what's happening is a particle is jumping, it's dragging other particles across across their wells, but it this keeps on dragging and dragging, and so at every time, it's always the elastic couplings are sort of sufficiently strong now that they can basically keep particle dragging, as you know. So I jump, the Jabers jump, everything jumps, and then again they jump, and they jump.
But in here, you're ramping up the force?
Yeah. I can get the force out of this description, okay? But I'm not interested in it right now. Yeah. Okay. So I'm ramping up the protocol is I'm ramping up the force until I get the particle to a cusp. I let the avalanche, and then, you know, I have to ramp up the force some more. In fact, the force is, okay, so I can tell you what the force is. So, and then we get to the depinning transition. Okay. So I label the steps by tau, zero, whatever. I have now a control parameter, which is the maximum of z at step tau minus the maximum of z at this threshold configuration. You see, the maximum of z is decreasing from step to step. So in some sense, if you know this maximum of z, the threshold force is just this times a number plus another number. So it's a linear combination. So knowing the distribution of this is the same as knowing the distribution of the threshold force. Okay? And so this difference is kind of your control parameter or the reduced force in the system. And in fact, these z's are actually what Sue would be calling the curvature variables in this problem. So the evolution to threshold is that this reduced x goes towards zero from above, okay? So is this critical? Well, we can sort of, you know, as I said, this thing is a guy jumps and another bunch of guys jump. This furnishes a correlation length, and I can count how many people jumped during an avalanche. So that's the avalanche size. So I want to see how does this thing go with my control parameter. And this is the result. Now, this is, of course, large simulations, but since this is 1D, very doable. The circles are basically simulation system sizes from 100,000 to 2 million, and then, you know, in the parentheses is the number of disorder realization, you know, which ranges from 100,000 for the smaller one to 5,000 to the bigger one. What you're plotting is the control parameter multiplied with the system size to the 1/2 against the expected avalanche size at that control parameter divided by the system size to the square. And what you should see is that all of these, you know, collapse nicely onto a finite size scaling plot, which shows you that the exponent x goes like x to the minus nu, where nu is 2. And as the expected avalanche size at parameter x grows towards the criticality, goes like x to the minus gamma, with gamma equals to 4. And these are the basically functional renormalization gain.
The avalanche, what it is the difference from the initial configuration. Not the instantaneous.
No. So basically, for example, if we go back, yeah. So, for example, the avalanche is basically the distance between the area between these two curves.
Ah, okay.
The area between these two curves is the avalanche.
Okay.
So there is criticality, and sort of the shot is if you do the coagulation friction here, you get the solid lines.
So this is the mean avalanche approaching the...
Yeah, the disorder averaged mean avalanche approaching the critical, yeah. And sort of, you know, here somewhere around here you have the, you have of course the transition into the finite size effect regime. Okay, so in order to get a little bit more mileage, you have to understand what is happening during an avalanche. Okay, so here is, here was the prescription. Okay, here is the prescription. So what is happening is, you know, record the maximum of H, of Z, that is HC. This guy is attaining it, it goes down by minus 2, the neighbors go up by plus 1, okay? Now, in order for these neighbors to trigger an avalanche, their Z has to be bigger than HC minus 1, so that they're basically thrown above the HC level, okay? So this tells you immediately, if I start here, I will go to the left until I hit the first site that is below this line, and the same I have to go to the right until I hit the first site that is below the line. That is basically gives me the left and right extent of the avalanche. So this is basically the area into which the avalanche will be confined, and that will be a natural measure for the correlation length in the system. So basically, these guys will basically jump by plus one because of these, you know, they are the neighbors, okay? And when you then ask yourself, and you can work this out, this is very fairly simple in this. So, you know, how many times, you know, this is what you were asking, how many times have the particles jumped from the last configuration? Everything to the left of JR has not jumped at all. Everything to the right of JR has not jumped. And in between, you get this trapeze. The area of this trapeze is exactly the avalanche size. The base of this trapeze is the correlation length. And you know, if you know this side, then the area is just a simple formula, okay? And the size of this, because of the strong pinning, basically, this is basically a trapeze. There is, you know, you have a corner here, you have a corner here, there is another corner here. And in fact, once the avalanche has completed, the net effect is, the net effect of the avalanche is, all the Z values between JL and JR remain the same, except for the guy that started the avalanche, which goes down by minus one. A mirror image of this guy with respect to the avalanche goes down by minus one, okay? And the boundaries go up by plus one. Okay, so this is the site of this mirror image. Everything else remains the same, and this is not surprising because the change in Z is the change in rho, which does not change, plus the change in delta M, okay? And you see, this is basically, the change in Z is the change in the curvature. And the change in curvature is here, it's a positive curvature here, plus one exactly, a negative curvature here, a negative curvature here, a positive curvature here. So basically, because of the strong pinning, the strains are relieved basically at microscopic locations of the order of the system size. So this is why you need to have another cusp, because there's no way this thing can go down here without another second minus, okay, minus here. This side is important. Because you see, this has been kicked out, clearly kicked out below the HC minus one line. Okay. Again, apart from this side, everything is within this strip of width one. Okay. So this is basically important because this means the avalanche has, in some sense, conditioned that region. Okay. A region where an avalanche is occurring is what I call an active region. Okay. Has a region where an avalanche has occurred before is an active region. Everything else is pristine. And it turns out the growth in how far an avalanche propagates in a pristine region is kind of, you know, you flip a coin until you get ahead. Okay, that is of limited length, always, okay? This is of always limited length, and that length will be, if the system size is sufficiently large, that length will be negligible, okay? On the other hand, these active regions are basically like highways. Once you enter a region where an avalanche has happened before, the only thing that can stop you is a stop site. That's why we call these guys stop sites, because they have a Z value that is way lower than everything else, okay? And it is basically the propagation of avalanches in active regions that is giving rise to the growth of the correlation length. Okay, so in order to sort of show this, this is kind of, again, a small system. Here is the change in the configurations. This is kind of the world line picture, okay? So here are the particle indices. Here is the avalanche step, okay? So every vertical is an avalanche. So the first avalanche happened here. The second avalanche happened here. The third avalanche happened here. The fourth. As I said, every avalanche produces a stop site. The stop site, this is the world line of the stop site, okay? So this avalanche at this point in time created a stop site. This is the stop site, this is the stop site, and you see, it serves as a terminating point for a new avalanche, okay? And then I've also colored the avalanches. Black avalanches are avalanches that completely happen in pristine sites, okay? And as I said, so these, their lengths will be in the limit that the system size goes to infinity. Their lengths will be limited. They will stay of order one compared to the system size. The red ones are avalanches where one end is in a pristine site, and the other one is in an active region. Okay, you see, once it stops at the pristine site and it expires the stop site, but instead gives you another one, okay, stop site. And the blue ones are avalanches where both ends are in active regions. Okay, so we need to kind of propagate, we need to keep track how the active regions are growing, and this is what I show here now with this green. Okay, you see this avalanche started, it started in our active region of this size. Okay, this red avalanche here grew this active region. The blue avalanche here merges this active region with another active region. And it's this merger process that gives rise to the increase of the correlation length in this model. Okay? So this is what it would look like in a big system where you probably are not dominated so much by finite size effects. This is a system of size 100,000. This is the rescale thing. So again, blue are the merger processes, red are the sort of growth processes, but the dominant, you know, the grooming, so the sort of the growth, the red is kind of microscopic growth, and then once in a while, in fact half of the time, you get a massive merger and you get suddenly a bigger active region. Okay, so it's the growth of these active regions is what I claim is a coagulation process. And this is kind of actually easy to understand. So basically, the basic process, the one that survives the limit that the system size goes to infinity and gives rise to the scaling behavior, is the following. As we said, the avalanches start at the sites with the largest C. Okay. Now, this will overwhelmingly happen in active regions because most of the sites will be, you know, by the time this thing starts to scale, most of the sites are in active regions. Okay. Now, in active regions, you know, you ask yourself, what is the probability that this avalanche will start in this active region? And it actually depends linearly on the size of the active region. Namely, the bigger the active region is, the larger the probability is that it will start there. So there is a preferentiality, and this basically is relatively robust. It does not depend strongly on what kind of, you know, whether the disorder is correlated or not, as long as it is exchangeable, as long as it can sort of, you know, permute the disorder and the result doesn't change. Okay. Then this new, so basically avalanches start predominantly in big active regions and then they spread into other active regions and merge them. So we have a coagulation process, active region of size L merges with an active region of size L2, giving you an active region of size L1 plus L2. You can now basically write a growth equation. You can actually write a mean field equation because, you see, if I take this at this region, okay, basically I can cut this everywhere along the pristine sites, and I can permute this because these avalanches, this guy doesn't know about anything happening here, about anything. So at any height here, I can permute these active regions, and I will not alter the statistics. So there is a self-averaging in here, and that self-averaging basically leads to an equation of this form. The number of active regions of size L at step T is given by this, and this is basically the interaction kernels. You know, it is with the preferentiality, with the proportional L of L prime with this probability, you pick the avalanche starts here. It picks a neighbor which has a distribution that is now given by this to give you one of this, and then these are the losses. This actually is a Smoluchowski equation. Because of this form, this is the kernel is basically called, it's an additive kernel, and this thing has an exact solution.
So, but why do you say that the bigger active regions are more probable just because they have more size?
Yeah, they are more. Yeah, you're looking for the maximum, and the maximum is a property. You don't care what the value of the maximum is. Okay, you're looking for the maximum, and the maximum is basically proportional to this.
Okay. So the starting point will not be the stopping point will be where the avalanche end are these points.
The stop sites. Yeah, exactly.
Okay,
yeah. So basically, yeah.
And there you do not consider anymore the growth. The red ones, right?
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And this comes with the price.
So,
yeah, so okay. Okay, so now we're coming to memory. Okay, so this is, you can match this with the Smoluchowski. This is sort of the exact solution of the Smoluchowski. Let's go to memories. Okay, for the rest, I'm more than happy to. It turns out, okay, the correlation length is then given as the second moment of the active region size distribution. This is the dominant term, okay. You have now you have something for the active region. You know, it shows the coagulation process. The expected avalanche size is the third moment of this active region size distribution, and then this is essentially the blue line, and this black one is the Smoluchowski assumes that the system is infinite, the system is finite, this is where the solution marches to infinity, blah blah. Okay, so now we're going to memories. Okay, let me just get a...
I still have another question. question. So this was for this model. How general can this be?
You know, it does not depend strongly on the choice of disorder.
And interactions, right?
It does, yeah, because you see, in the end, a lot of the microscopic has disappeared. You see, a lot of the microscopics has disappeared. What was left over? So this is kind of a model that also shows you, you know, where you can see what you lose as you go to the large scale. Okay, so this, you know, there was sort of, so let me keep
this. Did you find a class of models that would...
Maybe, I haven't thought about. Yeah, but this would be sort of the sort of typical next things that you would do. But let's do now memories, okay? So remember, I give you an up algorithm, you know, for the up force. But this, I could also, of course, do the force downwards, okay? And for the force downwards, I get another algorithm. In this case, the guy with the smoke, in the up, the guy with the largest set will jump. This is the update rules, okay? In the down, the guy with the smallest set, this will be a negative one, will jump. Its m will go by minus one because it's going a bell back one. These are the update rules. So now I have two processes. I will call the up. U operator. D is a D operator. The U operator takes the configuration and moves it to the next upwards. The D moves the configuration down. Okay. So this is the lower and upper threshold configurations are like absorbing states because every configuration, when you do sufficiently up, will go into the upper threshold state. Every configuration, if you do sufficiently number of downs, goes to the low. So it's, you could even, from now on, you can think about your favorite magnet. Think about random fields. So the up is like the positively magnetized saturated state. The down is the negatively magnetized saturated state. Okay? And so I have an operator U that gets you from one magnetization state to the next one, and the D gets it, you know, in the opposite direction. Okay. For this model that I have shown you, this is the lower threshold configuration. The blue one is the upper threshold configuration, and every other dot is an intermediate. So if you do the up avalanche one, you get to configuration 3, then you get to configuration 4, you get to 2. When you do down from here, you get to this configuration. You could sort of increase the force until you trigger a transition, then decrease it, okay? Then increase it and increase it, and you go back, okay? So this is basically like the main hysteresis loop of my pseudo-magnet, pseudo-particle system. And now I want to understand this. Okay, the first goal is to understand this and say, describe something. This is, in fact, what Merz's thesis started with. And then we realized, okay, so it has a nested structure. I know that basically everything under up has to flow to the saturated state up there. Everything under down has to flow here. So there is really, on this graph, there is two trees sitting in it. That's what I call the double tree. This is the tree under up. This is the tree under down. And basically the loops are objects that sit on both trees. Okay, so this is kind of like the way I kind of think about this is, you know, these two trees are kind of hugging into each other. So, you know, the hysteresis pattern comes from the way that, you know, the two trees are laid out on the same set of vertices. Okay, it's kind of an interweaving pattern. Okay, that's how these things come about. Okay. So, in this model, like the random fieldizing model, return point memory is an important feature. Okay. So, the first thing that I want to do is basically discuss the return point memory. I will use the toy model or the random field just as inspirations. I want to do a little bit of model building, you know, by educated sort of what can I learn from the toy model? What are the useful ingredients to extract the model? A sort of a general framework. And I will call this framework, I don't have a better name. If you have a better name, okay, this is, I call it the Dhamma Discrete Absorbing Monotonous Automaton. Itai.
Sorry, the variable that you're changing to move from one point to another is the force again?
Yeah, so this is basically, you see, I have two, we've talked about one algorithm, the black arrows, right? It takes the configuration, gives me a new configuration.
Right. So how do you go down?
The red is the one you look, you know, in the blue, in the black one, you look the side with largest C, you're basically increasing the force upwards.
Yeah.
In the negative force, you're sliding it down, so you need to look at the particle that is sort of furthest ahead in the other direction.
Yeah.
Okay, so two operations on a set of configurations. So I will now take this and generalize this to some abstract automaton model that will teach me hopefully a few lessons, and then I will talk about forcing in memory. Yeah.
And so the idea is that you keep going, if you keep doing this,
I will get there, yeah. So just you know, we will get there, but I need to build up a little bit, okay? But this is exactly where I'll be heading, just bear with me. Okay, so abstract formulation dhamma, AQS dynamics, okay, as Sri was also talking. In these cases, the configurations have the structure of a partially ordered set, okay? And I will denote this order by gamma. Here's maybe just sort of, see, I have a configuration here. When I apply an avalanche, I get a configuration here. Okay, so, you know, I would say that these MIs, this is configuration 2 of 2, are greater or equal than MI of 1. Okay, this is the configuration 1. Okay, but for example, I could also have a configuration like this. Okay, this has no order relation with anyone. In some places it's bigger. Okay, so this is why it's a partial order. Okay, this is a partial order set. Okay, and then the U and D's preserve the partial order, basically meaning that if I have a sigma and I compare it with the configuration that I get when I apply U, it's partially ordered bigger, U is up, okay, D is down. Likewise, if I have a configuration sigma, I compare it with D sigma, it is less, okay. So now in the graphs, what did I show you? I have a configuration sigma. Under U, I go to a state nu. This is one step of the algorithm. I show this as a solid arrow. The Ds are red solid arrows. Sigma goes under D to a configuration mu. That's the red arrow. The other thing that is useful that I need to talk about is what I call an orbit. Okay, an orbit is you start from sigma, keep on applying U, and you're bound to end up with the upper threshold, which I will call omega. Okay. From the same sigma, you keep on applying D, you're bound to approach alpha, and that's, you know, that's the D orbit. And I show the orbits by U star, okay, meaning like a wild card, apply all the necessary U's, and I will show it as a dashed line, okay? So black dashed is a U orbit, red dashed is a D orbit. Now, the return point memory basically prescribes the following. Let mu and nu be the endpoints of a loop, which means from mu, I have a U orbit that passes through nu, and at nu, I have a D orbit that gets me back to mu. Okay, so this is basically two things that are getting into there. Okay, then it says, look, consider any state, for example, so this is what I mean by a loop, okay, consider any state that is sitting on the U orbit, okay, U nu, U square, or this should be, sorry, this should be a mu, okay, U square mu, blah, blah, okay, and consider their D orbits. So where do these things, where do these states flow under D, okay? Now, I know that eventually they all have to end up in alpha. But the return point memory said, well, before you even get to alpha, all of you have to pass through mu. Okay? All of you have to pass through mu. And then whatever you do is another business. Likewise, the guys sitting on the D orbit, okay, their U orbits have to all first pass through mu. This is what return point memory says before it does anything. Okay? And it turns out, and this was sort of the surprising thing, with just with this feature, you can say a lot about, you can tell a lot about things about this graph, and you can understand it. So this is model independent. This is the same true for anything that has this form of return point memory. The following next slides will be basically completely universal. Okay? So, now, Karin and Jim Sedna sort of have basically, you know, spelled out conditions under which you get return point memory. From the charge density wave business, there is Middleton's no crossing property, okay? If you have this and you apply AQS dynamics, you're bound to have return point memory. It's a simple, beautiful argument, okay? But these conditions are sufficient. They're not necessary, okay? That's to keep in mind. Let me show you what Middleton's no passing means, okay? Excuse me. So, suppose you have a state nu, and you consider a state mu on its d orbit. So you started from here, you did down, 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 you ended up somewhere here, okay? Now, Middleton says, take any sigma that is ordered between these two, okay? Its d orbit has to pass through mu. That's what Middleton says, okay? Now, so Middleton makes a very, very, you know, bold, well, very, very big statement, okay? Any, it says, you know, once you have this, take any sigma that's in between there, you'll end up here, okay? Now, with this, you can prove return point memory. Because, okay, so here is mu that goes to mu. Let this sigma not be any sigma, but let this be a sigma, okay, that is on this boundary. By Middleton, it will pass through nu, okay? Middleton basically says, you know, you don't really need this boundary. It would do it. It would do it anyways, okay? So this is why this is a much more kind of, it demands more than you need to get this. Yes, Sri?
As I understood the no-passing statement, We start out with configuration.
Yeah, but this
order magnetization in that context.
This is the ordering. And if the outer one goes, if the outer one goes to where, the middle has to go.
So as long as the fields remain ordered, the magnetization.
Yeah, but basically, it is basically, it's what you will show is that, you know, it's basically, you have a higher field here, you have a middle field here. This goes in here, the middle field has to go there as well. Basically, this comes out of no passing. This is no passing in a situation to show what, you know, RPM demands less than this, okay? And I will basically, you see, this is why no passing is sufficient, but it's not necessary to get RPM.
Well, this is what I was thinking, because you seem to be saying a little bit more, because you're saying that sigma will map to mu, which is not, it is more than what we know.
But as I said, I'm using no passing as a kind of bad character, okay, to sort of, you know, highlight the, so, okay, yeah, you're right, but let's just keep this there. So, as I said, no passing implies RPM. It's sufficient, but it's not necessary for RPM, okay? And no passing is a global property in the sense that it basically applies to any states ordered like this. Whereas you see here, my RPM only applies to states that are on this orbit. You see, I could think about the sigma. I've prepared my system in a state mu. I know that mu nu are endpoints of a loop. I apply a little bit of u, okay, and then I look where the d goes. So it's kind of, this sigma is dynamically connected, okay? It's not just anyone that is in between here, but it is dynamically connected in a way to this loop, okay? So this is sort of a softer version than this. And so my question will be, what can I do with this no passing? And what can I do with this soft no passing, okay, I can understand the nesting of loops, and I can show you that this loops, this loop nesting has a natural representation of a tree, because it's a hierarchy, it's like a genealogical tree, okay? You see, the no passing does more than what I might want in a model, okay? One of the things is, under no passing, the transient length, so this is now, suppose, you know, I have the system with no passing RPM, okay? I drive the system periodically, I am in a periodic state after at most one transient. That is basically the extra, this is what you get from now. And this means, you know, from a kind of memory perspective, maybe this is limited because, you know, this is kind of like a sticky system. I mean, it immediately finds a place and it's happy and it's merry. It doesn't shop around too much, okay? And since it doesn't shop around too much, it doesn't really kind of, you know, probe the disorder landscape that you have, okay? So this is why you should probably consider an RPM without no passing, okay? Is this possible, okay? This is what the Dhamma is kind of trying to do, okay? So what do you expect? Well, the RPM will basically not, you see, RPM will not say what happens once you get outside of the loop, but it will control what is happening inside this loop, okay? And in fact, this RPM has a marginality property that Sri was talking about. And in fact, there are systems exhibiting RPM without no passing. In fact, one way that you're guaranteed essentially not to have RPM is if you have antiferromagnetic interactions, and there are apparently antiferromagnets, experimental as well simulated, that simulate RPM. So, which means that no passing is not necessary to have RPM. Okay. So in that sense, my Dhamma is kind of an honest model in that it implements RPM and nothing but RPM, okay? So this is okay. And so you can, if you can work out the predictions of this model, you can use this as a comparison, you know, against any realistic other thing, you can, which has marginality and these things, okay? So this is the rest of the plan for this. And so let me again recap what we had here, okay? So these were the transitions, these are the orbits, this is what RPM means. And maybe the one thing, with a loop like mu nu, I can associate states by applying field histories. I go a little bit up, I go a little bit down, I go a little bit, I end up with state, okay? This is basically a state that you can reach from the endpoints of this loop. And you can make this, so with these loops, and I will leave this here, I can make this more precise, but I don't want to. But with these loops, you can associate a set of states, okay? Maybe those that you can kind of, for which you can apply field histories that are somewhat confined to this loop that you can reach from one of these boundary endpoints of this loop, okay? So, now the question is, suppose I have, this is now all consequences of this honest-to-goodness RPM, okay? The question is this, you have a mu nu loop, okay? Consider some state sigma on the boundary of this loop. RPM tells you that, you know, you have to go down here, so you have a loop mu sigma, okay? Now, suppose this epsilon is a state associated with the loop mu sigma. What you can easily show is that under u's, this epsilon has to go to here, to this sigma first, and under these, it has to go here, Okay, so this is the loop. So now, suppose there's another state between sigma and the endpoint of this loop, okay? Okay, call this, this is, you know, call eta, this is the state that you just get when you apply one u. Now, RPM tells me that if I consider the d orbit, so if I consider what happens to this state, if I keep on applying a series of d, I need to end up here. The question is, how do I end up here? Can I sort of get into this state and then go down here? Or something else? And this, so this epsilon is a state that is not on this boundary. Suppose it's not on the boundary, okay? You'll get immediately a contradiction. See, if suppose, you know, this d orbit basically kind of hops over the boundary and ends up here, okay? Then look, I have a loop, okay? The loop is basically from nu, from epsilon to eta, right? The sigma now happens to be a boundary state of this loop, so its d orbit has to pass through here. Okay, but by assumption it's not passing. This was, I said it was not on the boundary, so this is a contradiction. So this cannot happen. Okay, so this is impossible. So the only way that this eta can call the mu is basically it has to stay somewhat outside the inside of this loop. And there are two ways. It can just go and then hit this loop here for the first time, or it can basically hit upon the, an intermediate state on this boundary, and then it just coasts down the boundary. These are the only two possibilities. And with this, basically, now, I have a notion of the interior of this loop and what is outside of it. Okay? This is the notion of interior and outside in this. And this allows me now to basically unpack this, this loop nesting structure that is sitting in here. So the first thing that I have to do is then, you see, again, I have the loop mu nu. The first thing that I have to do is I take a boundary here, and I ask, where does this orbit hit the d boundary for the first time? Okay, suppose it hits the boundary at the mu I, that is not this. This is possible, and it will, okay, it hits this here, okay? I know that any guy above here has to hit this down boundary, at least here, or higher above, okay? So basically, all of these guys have to go to mu, but this is not like a chaos. You see, there is a flow, and these flows can be merging, but there is an ordering. They don't cross, okay? There is a, basically a, some kind of no crossing that's happening. Likewise, you see, if you see these guys all, and everything in between, of course, is basically funneled in here, okay? This is, so you need to look at the last guy that gets here, okay? And then suppose you have a guy that is one above this, okay? What does this go under D? It has, again, it has to stay clear of everything else and it has to land up here, okay? So you have basically two mappings from this boundary to this that have to have certain monotonicity properties, okay? And you can work this out. This is, you know, and this is all just with this RPM property that have this monotonicity property. And with this now, you can break down a loop into subloop in a standard way, okay? You have a procedure to breaking loops down. Basically, you have a loop mu nu, okay? There are two possibilities. So this is the standard procedure. Okay, you could define another procedure, but you know, with this, since you know that these kind of orbits, you know, you can basically carve out. You see, these, if there are loops, they are kind of stacked. One loop like this in this manner. And then you can come up with a good way of, you know, of defining a standard procedure of how to break out a loop. And so according to the standard procedure, there are two possibilities. Either the loop breaks down into two pieces, or it breaks down into three pieces. It breaks down into two pieces if basically the last guy that flows into mu without hitting any other place on the boundary is actually the last guy before you get into mu. Okay? In that case, the last guy from here that goes to mu has to go in here. So basically, you have basically two loops, and then you have just one transition. This is the special case. The generic case is this is the last guy that hits mu before it hits, you know, that hits the boundary for the first time. This is the last guy that gets to mu, you know, directly. Okay, and in between, you can just fit one more loop. Okay, and this is the breaking into three. So you can represent this, of course, like a father and son relay, or, you know, a genealogical tree. This is the parent loop, mu nu. In this case, the parent loop, mu nu, is broken down into loop mu nu minus 1, mu n minus 1, and the loop mu 1 n, okay? In this case, the parent loop, mu nu, is broken into three loops, mu nu I, mu 1, mu n minus 1, and mu j and n. Okay? And you see this is like a genealogical tree. And so now you can apply this to an example. So let's show how this composition works. So this is the parent loop from 1 to 2, from 2 to 1 back. This is the genealogical tree. And let me step through this. So at the top level, I have the loop 1, 2. Okay? It breaks down into three loops, a single kind of trivial loop of a single node 2, a loop 4, 6, and a loop 3, 1. one tree, okay. Then it breaks down. So you see the reds are, we are now at the fourth generation, and then when I, so you see, and then this one, at the end, you either have doublets, or it is tripled in the figure eight thing, and that breaks down into this. This is a tree representation.
So, but these are all loops that are inherent in the original configuration.
Yeah. In a way, yeah.
And so, if you train the system,
I still haven't talked about training, but I'm getting there, I think. Okay. So the next thing is, okay, so I've kind of told you what's happening outside of a, inside of a loop, okay? So the structure inside of a loop, basically you can associate a tree. The next thing I want to ask, of course, what happens when you get out of a loop? Okay, so I need to sort of tell you now the transition, what happens to mu under d, and what happens to nu under u, okay? So there's two possibilities, really. Either the loop that you started was really just a subloop of a bigger loop, okay, or actually it was not, okay, so which means from mu you get into some other loop, somewhere in that other loop, and then from mu you get into some other loop, okay, either the boundary or the inside. So for this one, you know, then I could ask, is this still part of a other loop? And so, you know, given a loop, there is a natural kind of biggest loop that will house it, and that's what I will call a max loop, and I will show this like this, okay. This, and then, you know, and so basically my basic units would be maximum loops. The RPM tells me whatever happens in the maximum loop. So the next thing for your training questions is exactly what happens, what is the connection pattern on the level of maximum loops now? Okay, because what's happening inside the loop, I've already sorted out in a way, okay? That's RPM. What I'm now asking is what happens, you know, this is a, so I want to look at the graph where each of these loops is a node, and I'm looking at the transition of these nodes. Okay? So this is returning to our toy model from, you know, from the beginning of the talk. This is the flat state, okay? This is the threshold to threshold loop, okay? And what I was basically from the flat state, what I've done is the following. I basically just I go up, I get a new state. I go down, I get a new state. So I basically try to find all the states that I can do, okay, to get them. This black arrow here is the coagulation process. Okay, this is the coagulation process. Of course, it's a very tiny system, but this is the coagulation process in the up-down. This red arrows is the kind of reverse coagulation process. What you should see is, you see, you have loops. I have always coded the colors of the endpoints as blue, but you see, this is sort of the purple loop. This is the blue loop here. This is the light blue loop. There's another loop here. Okay, all of these loops are governed. Everything in these are the maximum. Each of these are governed by RPM. Okay, so what I'm really interested in is in the interloop pattern, and this is now the interloop graph. So now each of these blues is basically a loop, and this is, you know, from this, from the upper end point you go into this loop, from the low end point you get into this loop, and of course all of this ends up in the main hysteresis loop where you stay. Okay, so now I want to talk, this is the last part, so if you allow me, I want to talk about forcing and you know the memories in the system. So this is, so basically, this has now to do with basically how long I wander in this graph before I hit the cycle. Because obviously, in order to get a periodic response, right, I need to be moving somewhere around the cycle, okay? And basically, either I'm already in a loop, then I have a chance to remain in the loop. But if I'm getting out of the loop, I need to know where I'm getting and how long I have to search. And that ultimately has to do with the wiring of this interloop graph, okay? How is this loop graph wired? But now I need to talk about forces, so I need to introduce forces into my Dhamma model, okay? And this is basically the trapping fields. And this is, okay, so I introduce trapping fields. So for every configuration sigma, I introduce a lower and upper trapping field, which means that the sigma is stable for forces between the lower field and the upper field. Okay, so each configuration has it. So for these force ranges, it is same. Now, for the absorbing states, I will basically say, you know, its lower trapping field is minus infinity, so you can never get out of the absorbing state in the low. And for the other ones, its absorbing field is plus infinity, you cannot get out of this, okay? Now, these trapping fields, I cannot assign completely random because they have to have a monotonicity. Namely, if I have a configuration sigma and it has an upper trapping field F plus, if I consider a configuration U sigma, it has to have a trapping field F plus that is bigger than that. Because in the end, you know, my transition is exactly from this force to a new configuration that is stable at a larger force. Okay, at the same, it is in the same way, if I have a configuration sigma with a trapping field, lower trapping field F minus, the configuration that you get D sigma must have even a lower trapping field. These are the only two things that I require. I don't know anything about the F minus component under U. Okay, I don't know what happens to F minus when I apply U. I don't know what happens to F plus when I apply D. But this part I know, okay? Now, the evolution is simple. If you give me a sigma, I'm going to, and you give me a force, I'm going to go, say, suppose I'm going up, the force is increasing, I'm going to do ups, 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 until I find a force, a configuration, whose value, whose trapping field is lower or equal to my force that I have dialed. So this is basically, okay, so this is the, this is this. So, here is the summary. Now, of course, I can also assign a trapping field to a loop. You see, the trapping field for a loop, basically, what is the for? Everything in here leaves the loop through nu. So basically, in order to leave the nu, you need to know what is the trapping field F plus of this nu guy. Okay? Because if you have an F greater than or equal, you're basically getting out here. If you have an F less or equal to F minus of nu, you're getting out here. Okay. So what I want to do now is, okay, so now we're coming to the periodic risk. So I've now given sort of, you know, I have given you the state transitions, I've assigned kind of the trapping fields, you know, the intervals within which a configuration is being trapped. Now I want to start to force the system, and I'm almost done, okay? Okay, so now we're applying forcing. So let's suppose we start, first we start simple, okay? Suppose we're starting out with a configuration mu here, okay? So the two limits are, my force has to be bigger than F minus, this is a mu, okay, sorry. It has to be bigger than F minus mu, it has to be, it has to be in this interval, okay? The labeling there is wrong, sorry. Okay, suppose we do just what everyone does, okay? We increase the force up to here, then we increase it down, up to here, okay? So since you start out under up, you go somewhere up here. You're not getting there because you're below this line, and then the down, the RPM gets you down there. Okay, if you do this now half, okay, you'll get down here, half, this is the marginality. Okay, if you were somewhere else here, you could basically use the tree representation, and I can show this after you, to again show that, you know, after one cycle, you will end up in the period. But this is because you are in a loop, okay? Now, so having understood this, now let's look at the same thing at the loop level. So what happens if the amplitude is larger than what this loop can trap? Then I will start getting out into some other loop, okay? So remember, this was sort of the guy from just before. These are the loops. Now you see, each of these loops has two numbers, okay? The positive trapping and the negative. So what I should really do is, I should plot these coordinates, these things, I use these two numbers as a coordinate, okay? So that's what I've done here, okay? So basically, this is the direction in which the lower trapping field gets worse, basically stronger and stronger. This is the direction in which the upper trapping field gets stronger and stronger, okay? Down here, this is my threshold-to-threshold loop. You see, this is the one in which case you cannot really get out at all. So what I have done here is basically, this is arbitrary scales, okay? So this is basically, this is the smallest force, the next smallest force. This is kind of like, not the scalar value, but just the ordering of the forces, okay? So, you know, things looking like a square is just because, you know, I've given them numbers. But what happens, what is in this model is clear, there's two things. You know, some states have exactly the same lower and upper trapping fields, okay? So they would be falling on top of each other in order to prevent this. I'm slightly offset at them, okay? So these are kind of, you know, these are loops that have exactly the same trapping fields, so they're offset, okay? Good. Now, so you see, my monotonicity rules say that, you know, these, I should look at the black arrows, okay? My monotonicity rules say that the black arrows should always have a positive component, okay? The red arrows should always have a positive component. But what you look, when you look at these arrows, you see they're all going in the northeast direction. There, you know, it is, I don't have, you see, it is, when this black arrow goes up, it also goes, it has, it either stays constant here, or it also gets here. So this means that this loop is not only better trapping in the up direction, it's better trapping even in the down direction, okay? Which it didn't have to be. But remember, this is the toy model, there is no passing, and no passing tells me, no matter what you do, within one period, you are in a loop, okay? Okay, so basically, this is a consequence of no passing, and but it wouldn't have to be like that. So if you do this with the bigger, okay, then let's do the driving again to make Itai happy, okay? So suppose I start here. I drive the force up to some level F plus, say, corresponds to here. Okay, so if I'm anywhere here, I cannot go anywhere because I'm, you know, the levels are too high for me, right? If I'm anywhere down this line, I basically go as high as I can go, staying below the level. Okay, if I'm here under the upswing, I get into this loop. Okay. Now if I apply a negative part, this tells me you have to stay to the left of this line. So here I could go red, red, red until here. I'm in a loop. This loop is trapping. So, you know, and if I keep on repeating this, I basically stay in this loop and I do exactly what I've shown you before. Okay? For a bigger system, you know, this looks like this. But again, this is, you know, so what you see is all these arrows basically have non-negative components. So this is sort of the no passing, which does more than you were asking for, okay? But you could, of course, you know, cook up hypothetical models where, you know, so where, for example, you go up, you go in this loop, then you go in this loop, 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 go in this loop, go in, until you get into the trapping loop, okay? No passing will not allow you to do this, but this is a system which would have RPM without no passing, because RPM only tells you what happens inside the loop, but it does not strongly restrict what happens outside the loop. So this would be, you know, a 1, 2, 3, 4 periodic response. And of course, you could have systems with 5 or whatever response. And actually, you could also get subharmonic response in this if you do the wiring, okay? So maybe this is okay. Forget this part of the summary and conclusion. Matt will have a poster on these graphs, you know, where you can actually do some combinatorics. This was sort of. But so this is now where basically Nagel's epistemic cutoff starts. Well. Okay. My gift to you, sir. This is.
But you'll have to explain what the word means.
So, what?
You have to explain what the words mean.
Okay. Well, actually, Nagel is Sid. Epistemic has about, you know, boundaries of knowledge, what can be known, what cannot be known, and the cutoff is basic tells us that. Okay, so you want me to say the sort of the common, you know, the sort of the common version of the, okay, it's the bullshit line. Okay, well, we know this. Okay, sort of in a more politically correct kind of, you know, but sort of, you know, if we were philosophers, you know, this would be the technical term for it, okay? Nagel's NEC, okay? This is the NEC. All right, so, I mean, you know, it's basically, I really use this toy model as a kind of, as a vehicle to abstract something, you know, and get something more general. There's a few things that I can throw out of this model. The partial order is probably not essential, because in the end, you only care about the trapping fields and their monotonicity properties, okay? So you can model the problem just in terms of the trapping fields, two operations. These U and Ds are, of course, random objects, because they depend on the graph, you know, on the disorder, whatever. So the model would be, you have a set of states. You have two sets of transformation maps, or what Sri would call transformation matrices, which have, you know, if they have RPM, then I've told you what the properties are that these matrices should have. I have a set of trapping fields defined on the configuration, which have to have certain monotonicity properties, but not else. And maybe I didn't have just one pair of absorbing states, but I had an all set, a whole set. You know, this would not be too hard to sort of generalize this. The periodic response requires cycles in the state transition graph, if this is clear. RPM guarantees marginality, namely when you're in a cycle and you reduce the amplitude, you're automatically still in a cycle. The sort of so basically this begs kind of for a, so you basically the interesting stuff, the transients and all of this has to do with the interloop structure, namely how these loops are wired to each other. And so it's you, so this could be, you know, the natural thing is to cook up a random interloop trap model now, okay? So basically each loop is a vertex and it's a trap. We make random connections between vertices such that each vertex has out degree, because from each vertex you get out under an up or a down, out degree 2. For each loop, we assign a pair of trapping fields chosen at random but subject to monotonicity constraints, f plus increasing on u orbits, f minus decreasing on d orbits. And then you can sort of form ensembles of these, look at observables such as the expected length of transients, sizes of their basin of attractions at a given trapping level. Okay, and then, you know, maybe if you want to sort of, you know, have multiple memories, we need to make these transitions noisy. So there's always a chance not to follow the U, but maybe something like something similar. And, you know, the fact, for example, maybe, okay, this doesn't want to wake up. And then, you know, you could use probably also this formalism to kind of describe models that don't even have RPM. Like, for example, Sri was looking at the Schild-Encke model. Maybe you can use this to sort of, you know, what I have done is this model had a continuous parameter, but I was interested in the irreversible changes, right? So I have, in some sense, I discretized the model. I mean, something similar, and you know, this is now the naive theoretical physicist, but something, you know, you share the system, you know, of course the particles continuously rearrange themselves, but there are discrete events of topological transitions, you know, where the neighborhood of the particles changes. So maybe there is a way even to sort of, you know, extract out of these continuous configuration space, you know, a slightly coarser description which only codes the topological neighborhood relationships between the particles and looks at their transitions.
Okay, but that's what I think is not quite, at least, this is awesome.
Okay, so I think I'm done here. Okay.
But that's the part that I don't see quite there, which is that in systems like the shear reversal or in our gel systems, once you strain hard enough, the forcing is hard enough, the actual connections change.
Yeah.
So the network that you have has to be shifted.
No, but what I would care, you see, the actual, you see, it's, so in some sense, you know, what I would do, suppose you do this in 2D, okay? You have a configuration, I would say, just let me look at the Delaunay triangulation, okay? Meaning, you know, I label the particles, the neighbors, the nearest neighbors of, according to Delaunay, are, you know, particles. That would be my state. I shear it, the particles rearrange, so the triangulation changes, so I have a new state. So each triangulation of the configuration would be a state, okay? So the transition is from one triangulation to the other.
But then the return...
I'm thinking out loud, okay?
I'm trying to think as well. I'll tell you, I mean, in our system we have a gel network, and we strain it, and the gel will rip apart. We bring it back, it reforms, rip apart, reforms, rip apart, reforms, until you get a gel that can sustain that amplitude. And so I'm trying to think of whether or not your network needs to be reconfigured each time I rip the gel apart, or am I...
So the question to ask would be the following, maybe, and this is sort of, you know, okay, so so you would assume that you could, you know, suppose you had gels, okay, you know, if so what you would require for this idea to work is, suppose you produce gels, okay, 2D gels, if it's possible, okay, where the Delaunay triangulation pattern is exactly the same, but, you know, it's, of course, there's different micro configurations that would give you the same Delaunay pattern, okay? So they could be having different micro patterns, but their triangulation pattern is somewhat the same, okay? The question is, if you shear them, can I basically just say Delaunay is enough or something else? So if you shear them, do they go to the same, you know, coarse grain thing? Okay, maybe Delaunay is not the right thing to do, but is there a coarse grain sort of thing that say, if you have just this property, you know, don't, you know, and, you know, there's many, well, if then something like this is bound to apply.
But he's producing a model that does indeed produce these return port memories. He's not being constrained like you are.
But he's not allowing for training, right? So,
well, he's not built that in.
Right, so that's what I'm wondering is how, so in your model, the memories are there, right? They're in the original configuration, so the question of training is still, to my mind, something that we would need to build into a model like this, right?
In particular, as you're
moving this back and forth, your model has to somehow reconfigure itself.
No, it does not have to.
To train the thing.
Yeah, but this is exactly. So if I go back there,
Can I just sort of try to re.
Okay.
The question as I understand it.
Okay.
So I guess the question is, in your case, it looks like I can be sort of looking at any state of the system, and it is part of these loop structures.
Yeah.
Right? Whereas for the kind of systems that I was thinking about, not every gel structure will have the stationarity property under oscillatory shear.
Right, so that's the point. So if I have a reversible gel, then I'm in one of your loops. Okay. So if I can do this, then it doesn't matter if I do a small loop or a big, you know, until I reach the training threshold, I'm in one of your loops. But every time I break the gel to train it to get into a looped configuration, I need to reformulate your network. So there's something extra that I feel like I would need to build, you know, and so you sort of, you do this, and you randomize the network each time until you get something like what you have, which is a loop structure.
Maybe
so this is where the mathematicians back.
Yeah.
No, well, but I think
if that's useful. It tells us why.
So what will be happening is the following. Maybe let me try to sort of. I'm not understanding exactly. Let me sort of rephrase what I kind of wanted to get across, and then, you know, because I'm not sure that you have to rewire, but there's something not I'm understanding, so I'm telling you why I think you don't have to necessarily rewire. Okay, so look at this thing. So each of these is a loop. Okay, suppose I start in a state inside this loop. You know, if the amplitude is not so big, then I'm basically sitting there, right? If my amplitude is too big, okay, then, you know, on the upswing I get into here, the downswing, however, gets me still out of the loop, okay? Uh-huh. And then the up gets me still into a new loop, and then the down gets me into a new loop. Then maybe here, finally, I've hit upon the loop, okay, that is trapping for the pair of amplitudes. And so this is where the training phase has ended, and now I'm basically cycling here. So for this, it's basically, I don't have to remap. I have a transient. Maybe here you start, you have to really hop a long time, okay? But how long the transients are, you know, it will depend on this wiring structure. This is the part that I'm putting in by hand, okay? So this is, okay, this is the part that I'm putting in. You know, if the wiring, this is right now just sort of, if the wiring structure, you know, in terms of now trapping fields is such that I have like this, then, you know, forget it. I mean, you know, it's after one period, you're always bound in a loop, okay? But this is basically because the system has no passing a lot more than I'm asking. The generic thing is more something like this, okay, where, you know, your loop, it's not trapping, you get here, but then, you know, it is now trapping in the up field, but you've messed up your lower field, so you have to go down here, and then, you know, so you can have the transients.
So the idea is that you apply this until
you get into a trapping loop.
The thing that bothers me is that loop was initially there.
In
the original configuration, whereas like in the gel, I'm actually ripping the thing apart.
No, but are you always ripping it apart, or is it you only ripping it apart once you've gone past it?
No, initially I rip it apart all the time until I get to a configuration that is like one of these loops.
This space covers all configurations of loop gels also.
Right.
It is an abstract model in its way. Yeah. As such, it is kind of, you know, in some sense it explains everything, and therefore it doesn't explain much. Okay, this is, let me put it this way. When I started to look at these graphs, you know, there was just too much structure, and, you know, I wanted to understand what's really happening there. And I mean, I don't claim that I have solved sort of, you know, but the idea is maybe this is a useful kind of starting point to come up with a zoology, you know, of what kind of systems you have, you know, and your gels maybe not fitting in there, you know, maybe because, you know, Mehran was saying, you know, the phase space is so humongously large with sort of where, you know, that this is not of very much use. But I think there's probably a class of models, with RPM but without no passing, for which this could be a good starting point. Yeah.
Okay, so just before we go, I think we should make sure that we thank Mahith now. And now we can have a discussion about some of these issues, and those who want to stick around, we should do that. Okay, so.
And sailing. I have to leave, but I have two for sailing.
Okay, you have?
Two people for sailing.
Okay, all right, good. Let me just note this down because I'll forget this. Okay, Itai too. Okay, at least he trusts me on the board after this talk. That is good. Okay, Itai. Okay, yeah.
So I think.
Okay, yeah, Shri, go ahead.
Work to make a mapping structure like you would
be, yeah.
Right? So in general, if I start with some arbitrary configuration,
yeah.
Right, the mapping will, I mean, so the network can have dangling parts where I have feeder streams, which they're not part of a loop.
Yeah.
So I think the confusing thing in what you said was that you said in this model every state you can have is part of
a No, it doesn't have to be. You see, this could be just single state. You know, you can have states. You have the dangling structure. You know, this point could be a loop, or it could be just a single state, and it's just a transient state in there. You know, it's...
So those would be...
You
have sort of...
It's
lines coming to...
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Those are transient.
Yeah, yeah. And in fact, I think, you know, it's you know, for this
so
short...
Think, but we didn't see those lines in any of these diagrams.
Well, it's, you know, for example, you see this state is clearly transient, okay? You see, there's, once you leave it, you never come back to it. There's everything white, for example, here is kind of like a state that is, you know, not part of any loop. And you can these proliferate, of course, if the system, you know, there's, you know, these are ridiculously small systems because I wanted to put a graph that was, okay. So this, yes, you.
Thinking of possibly a model that generalizes yours that doesn't have the no passing rule.
Yeah.
Which is that rather than having your y's or your z's be one dimensional, they should be two dimensional in kind of goals.
Uh-huh.
And then configurations are like configurations of a Lux line, if you like.
Yeah, yeah.
And they can certainly pass each other.
You mean one line in three dimensions?
Yes.
Okay. Basically, you have a two-dimensional transverse direction now instead of a one-dimensional transverse direction, and you know, and then it's still a linear object, and basically, it's now a string like a flux line, really, that in its two-dimensional transverse. Yeah. So that could be. Yeah.
I just want to understand how much.
Well, so the disorder basically in this structure, let's just basically go back to the. The disorder basically is this map. I mean, you could, you know, this is, you have a set of configurations. Say,
can you replace it by
another tree?
Countably many ordered periodic landscape.
Countably. You want to tell me again what you exactly want to do?
Yeah, so you have chosen IID or continuous random.
That was not essential. You see, it's all these random variables, basically, in the end. So this is, for example, the map. This is a graphical representation of the map D. It is random because, you know, although this arrow could go here or something. The only, in this case, in this model, all I require is that it's a tree. Okay. Now, this map is a random variable in the sense that it depends on the disorder. Each disorder realization will give you a map, and in that sense, it itself is a random object. This is the map cut from a model, but I could just say, I could forget about the disorder, and I could just start with a random, you know, let there be a random tree, you know, with so many vertices rooted at this one. And I could sort of start with distributions over these trees. And then I would need two trees, basically. The other tree would be basically this one. So I would have a pair of random trees. That could be my basic random variable. I mean, in this model, it depends on the disorder, but it doesn't have to do in general. Yeah.
I didn't understand why there are either one, two, or three arrows getting into each node and not more.
This is a matter of the resolution. I think you might have somewhere here you have three.
No, three you had also in your example with the three.
Yeah, so this is basically the. This is related to the following. When you go from this blue to this. To the other blue, the stochastic process behind that, if we talk about the model, okay, it's a record-breaking process.
Mm-hmm.
which means that the number of states between here and here grow like the logarithm of the system size. So basically, and sort of in some sense, the number of states on the path from here to here, in a way, are a measure of how many paths flow in here. Okay. So basically, the typical average degree of a node is roughly scales with the logarithm of the system size. My systems are too small.
Okay, but that's not yet. It's a question of the size of the dependent.
Yeah, but the dependence goes like the logarithm of the system size. Well, thank you very much for your attention.